Yeah, even if it's not your thing, you could still respect it. You know, it's like, you know, I'm not like a huge country music fan, but I can tell the difference between good country music and crappy country music.
Yeah, there was a definite craft to how they did things. Soundgarden. Yeah. And then his follow-on efforts were also really good, too. Like I say, it just, I didn't like every song, but they had a handful, which was just like amazing. Right. Well, welcome back to another episode of Spam, Spam, Spam Humbug. This is episode 81, and you have got, by the look of it, you have five of us tonight. Let's see, who is online in the Discord channel? Oh, that's right. We say hello again to Balaron Dragon. Or perhaps not. Microphone issues? Oh no. We'll give him a minute. Draxanath is back, though. Hello, how are you? All right, then. Golden Flame Dragon is with us again.
Hello, everyone.
And Boolean Dragon is likewise here.
What's up, y'all? Freddie Freeman broke his wrist. Nightmare.
Indeed, I hadn't heard that.
What is up with everyone tonight?
We are just, I don't know, we're off our game. Maybe we can get back on our game. And maybe Balaron can get his microphone to work. Just say hello at various intervals, Balaron. Maybe we'll hear you at some point. All right, so what are we talking about tonight? Well, you know what? Before we get into that, we should, of course, as always, say a big thank you to some people because this episode of Spam, Spam, Spam Humbug is brought to you by our Patreon backers. So thank you to everyone who supports the podcast and the Codex by that means. And as always, a big thank you especially to our co-producers, Seth, Dominic, Chris, Violation, Adam, Avatars, Radio, Eric, Thorwan, Pascal, Neil, Helgriff, Aaron, The Hearth of Britannia, Edward, Stirring Dragon, and Cranberry. And you might have noticed there were a couple of extra names in that list over and above the entries on the list from last week, and that is because we have to give a couple of shout-outs. Stirring Dragon, of course, has contributed to the podcast before. He's kind of been a behind-the-scenes guy as well, and that's been great. But he has also been a Patreon backer of ours from fairly early on, and he recently bumped his pledge up. Oh, there's Balaron again. Can we hear you now? Alas. Where was I? Right, Stirring Dragon. He's been a backer on Patreon for a while, but he recently bumped his pledge level up, so thank you very, very much for that, good sir. And then likewise, Cranberry, our beloved Cran, has chipped in a little bit, and so, you know, is now helping to support the podcast and the Codex, and that's really, really awesome as well. Thank you kindly, Cranberry. Do we have any new Ultima Dragons this week? Well, I am actually sure that I wrote a few names down for, let's see here. Well, just one, although let me just make sure. There might be a couple of outstanding membership requests. I should just double check this because sometimes I don't always get around to handling the requests immediately when they come in. And I apologize for that if so. Ooh, there's two. So we say hello to, on Facebook now, Kelly, Bruce, and Michael. Welcome and splut to all. All right. So what are we talking about tonight? Well, I know Balaron had one thing that he wanted to talk about, and if we can get his microphone to work at any point, we will bring that up. But for the moment, I have a question. This is actually a topic that's been on our ideas list for a while, and I've not really known how to approach it, but I think we got a pretty good crew tonight to actually start picking it apart. You know, a lot of people who've really kind of, well, obviously, as people who've messed around with making their own games, especially games with an Ultima flavor to them at one point or another, side effects of gameplay features. Now, that's kind of a mouthful, so let's unpack that a little bit, okay? Because when we're talking about gameplay features, we could be talking about things like NPC schedules, day-night cycles, monster level scaling. And really, I suppose what I've wanted to look at from that is, you know, sort of the impact that these different gameplay features have, not only on the game itself, but on the player experience of the game. So, you know, we could be talking about things like immersion gameplay, but we could also just be talking about how, you know, sometimes the presence of these features and their proper working within a game can actually not always work in favor of player experience, or not always work in favor of the experience of at least certain kinds of players. I'll give you an example. I mean, one thing that I absolutely love about the Ultima games, or about many of the Ultima games, because not all of them have this, is the day-night cycles. You know, that was always a big draw for me. And again, I mean, I come at this from an Ultima 6 perspective. They were present in Ultima 7 as well. It was just so awesome to be able to see NPCs, you know, sleeping in bed at night, and then they wake up in the morning and they either sit down at the table in their house or they go to the pub in a simulacrum of having breakfast, and then they go to their shop and they tend their shop for a while, and then maybe they go have lunch. Then they come back to their shop, tend their shop a little while longer. Maybe they go have dinner, or they go home and have dinner there. Or again, I mean, like, Ultima 7 took this a little bit further, because Ultima 7, you would actually, like, see food appear and disappear on plates in front of them. Ultima 6 didn't do that. But, you know, still, like, they would go sit down at the bar or sit down at the table in their house, and then they'd get up, maybe mill around a little bit more, and then go to bed. Lather, rinse, repeat. It was the best thing. And they kept to those hours in another way, because it wasn't just the case of the NPC moving around, looking busy. You know, the NPC actually would tell you off if you approached them while they were sitting down to dinner and said, hey, I'd like to buy some equipment. They would tell you, that's nice. Or sometimes they wouldn't even say that's nice. Sometimes they just tell you, I'm closed, go away, bug me tomorrow. But, and it was neat, right? Because it really added to the feeling of Britannia feeling alive. Now, on the other hand, for some other kinds of players, that could wind up being an impediment, or I could see how that could be an impediment, right? You know, if, like, I've just finished a big raid on Dungeon Shame and a couple of other places, and I am laden with loot, and I come trekking into Britannia, into the city of Britain at 2 a.m., it kind of sucks having to wait 6 hours or 7 hours for Terry to show up at the mint. You know, I've got all this gold right now. Why can't I get gold coins for it? Well, you can't.
Yeah, it depends on your perspective, because, like, gamers, especially now, have been trained for things to be easy, not to be realistic. So, you know, if you've been trained that way and all the games work that way, and then you see something, you know, like Ultima 5 or 6 or 7 that had the schedules, you probably would be annoyed because it's unexpected and you're not getting what you want when you want it, which is kind of what video games are all about now for the most part. But, you know, somebody could be like, oh, this is cool. I have to find something to do. Hey, maybe I should go to sleep because everyone else is sleeping. It puts a real different flavor on it that doesn't really have to be bad.
I think the real, you know, you might come back from the dungeon laden with loot and have to wait to toss it to a merchant to make your cash. And that's an inconvenience. You could also come back from the dungeon poisoned and find that the healer is closed. And that's much more hilarious.
Mm-hmm. And our British is also asleep.
But I'm not sure how much we can really lay at the feet of gamers are used to things being presented to them and being lazy, given that to tie in one of the things that Balron wanted to bring up, the number one RPG of all time, according to Game Informer, was in fact Skyrim, where there were schedules. So I'm not sure we can say that players, you know, completely bounce off of them in a modern context.
Can you hear me now?
I can, Balron. Excellent. Glad to have you.
Awesome. Sorry about here. It took 2-3 freaking shutdowns on my browser for whatever reason. I was actually going to say that
the browser client is funky. Discord's browser client is funky. Always go desktop.
Yeah, I am on my desktop.
There you go.
Let's see. I was going to say it was Skyrim. I don't know if y'all saw the Game Informer one was actually zero. They got a zero countdown now. I was shocked by was just straight up Dungeons and Dragons by Gary Gygax. Is that what you all read? The first three
we got as
particularly
far as
greatest?
We got as far as Skyrim. And, like, we had talked about Chrono Trigger, which I think was their number two, and it was IGN's number one.
Yeah.
So
Oh, really? It was Chrono Trigger's number 3. Final Fantasy VI is number 2, right, which I think is awesome because Final Fantasy VI is one of my all-time favorites as well. I used to own the game. My brother used to own the game. I was going to say, if y'all like read further in, I don't know if y'all saw Ultima Games and some old PC games by Beeren Fargo got in the close range, like 13, Wasteland is 78. If you've ever played the PC version of Wasteland, the very first one, Might and Magic World of Xeen is 85.
Oh, you know, I made a comment about the fact that the Might and Magic game seemed absent from the IGN list.
Yeah, I think it's number 5 or number 6, because I have that collection, Clouds of Xeen and Dark Side of Xeen. I have that. Let's see. Now,
that is another topic that at some point we have to revisit, because I really want to know why more games haven't tried to do what Might and Magic 4 and 5 did.
Let's see. 58 is Bard's Tale, Tales of the Unknown. Yeah, another Beeren Fargo. I have that collection. Let's see. Oh, Oblivion's number 52. Elder Scrolls.
That's the inversion of how IGN looked at it, because I think IGN ranked Skyrim fairly high, but Oblivion even higher.
Yeah. Was it Oblivion? I thought it was Morrowind. I don't think Oblivion was on their list at all.
Oh, that's right. It was Morrowind. Never mind. Sorry, I'm wrong. Yeah, it was not
Oblivion. Yeah, Oblivion is not on IGN's at all.
Okay. Let's see. And then Wizardry, the first Wizardry. Oh, yeah.
I have a question. How many Ultima games are on that list? And are any of them not Ultima Underworld 4 or 7?
Well, 7 is number 31. Yeah. Let's see. Shroud of the Avatars in here somewhere because I flipped through this.
Huh.
And let's see. System Shock 2 is number 38. So I'm trying to point out
the IGN list as well.
Yeah. What's it ranked in IGN?
I don't have it in front of me.
Okay.
Hang on. I can pull that up because
Yeah, IGN's is online, but Game Informer's is you have to actually subscribe.
Paywall. Okay.
Ultima Online is number 17, and then Deus Ex is number 14.
Oh, okay.
That's shockingly high. Like you
owe that's awesome. I mean,
you didn't even appear in IGN's, although EverQuest was like number 100 or something.
Yeah. I think that's
was
amazing.
For IGN.
Wow.
Oh, okay.
System Shock 2 is 23.
Let's see. Where was Shroud? I know that they had Shroud in here. Start over.
It's kind of shocking given that it isn't even done.
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting game and getting progressively more interesting all the time, but I don't think it's quite top list material yet. You know what I mean?
Let's see.
I don't disagree.
Shadow Hearts. They talk about it somewhere in here, and if it's not in here, it's in the magazine in general.
Fair enough.
Somebody from Game Informer is playing it. Let's see. I just might be wrong. Let's see.
Like I say, they could have maybe done a feature on it, you know, somewhere close to the list, but not on it. Now, that said, Shroud's actually not a bad example. We just did a major digression from topic there, but that's fine. Shroud's actually not a bad example of, you know, where at least right now the gameplay features don't always work in favor of the game. I think there's a lot of really great potential in Shroud. I like a lot of what they're trying to do, and I mean, it is still in development. So, you know, please understand that I'm framing the criticisms that follow with that firmly in mind. You know, I realize that a lot of the system's work is not yet done on the game. There's a lot of tuning and a lot of adjustment that still is probably going to happen over the next few months and possibly into next year. I don't know how much longer of a development cycle we should really expect for that game. But just right now, there's bits and pieces of Shroud that don't work quite as smoothly as they should to really be effective systems. And again, I mean, that's kind of a subjective judgment on my part. I do find like the crafting system is still a little bit cumbersome to use in its odd sort of half gump, half menu driven way. Moving like the decoration system, moving stuff around your house, decorating your house, that actually has been nailed down pretty darn good. And maybe that's why one of the major community spotlight features for the last few months has been, you know, like player owned towns and really nicely decorated houses, because those systems they've really got, and they've done those very, very well. Whereas some of the other game systems, even including combat, not so much.
Kevin, let me mute my microphone.
No worries. Kevin, you were in the middle of something.
I got a couple things now. I'll do the most recent one first, since it's related to what we were just talking about. But I was thinking yesterday that on that top 100 list, there wasn't a single Legend of Zelda game. Now, maybe they don't consider that
right.
an RPG, but if you look at how many other things were barely RPGs that made that list, I don't know. It seems kind of hard not to say, well, Zelda could, I guess, be an RPG too. So that's weird.
Question for you then, Balron. Is there a Zelda game on the Game Informer list? Because there certainly wasn't an IGN. Okay, we'll come back to him. And that's maybe especially, you know, because there have been how many Zelda games? I mean, I guess if you count all the mobile titles, you're easily over a dozen. But you would think that at least one would have ended up on the list, especially now that, you know, Breath of the Wild at number 47. There you go. You would think that, that would have merited a mention. Especially now with Breath of the Wild, you know, really kind of pushing the, or trying to push the envelope on the, almost called it the Wii U. No, it's the Switch, the Nintendo Switch. It is on Wii U as well.
It seems a lot more RPG-ish than some of the other Zelda games. It seems like almost more like Skyrim or something like that.
Yeah, I don't know if maybe they were treating it as like an adventure-type title versus other things that were more RPG-ish. I mean, I can't really look at anything on IGN's requirements and think, well, that clearly delineates Zelda as not an RPG versus all these other things that are on this list for whatever reason. Interesting, too, actually, coming back to the IGN list, that, you know, a lot of their reasoning, if you will, you know, a lot of the criteria that they based their judgment of what is and isn't an RPG on was... a lot of it comes down to, you know, the same things we're trying to talk about here, right? The gameplay features, persistent character progression, combat, choice and consequence, story exploration, character building, all that good stuff.
Yeah, and the other thing, back to the original topic, we were talking about NPC schedules and what happens if you come out of the dungeon and you can't get healed because Lord British is in bed. I think it may have been Ultima 5, but I'm pretty sure an unintended side effect of... people sleeping because of NPC schedules was that you could actually murder Lord British when he was
six.
In bed. Ultima 6? Okay. So I'm pretty sure they didn't anticipate that one.
Yeah, well, that was just a quirk of the engine, because basically every sleeping NPC was represented by a single NPC that would just keep getting instanced over and over again every time they needed to show someone sleeping in a bed. And... So, I mean, if you looked at them, it would show you the portrait for the character that was supposed to be sleeping in that bed. But from the game's perspective, it was actually like a stand-in character that was just the sleeping guy. Consequently, they forgot to enable invincibility for the sleeping guy when it came to Lord British. So that was how you did away with him.
I think it's psychological more than anything, but... I remember when I played Ultima 6, when I arrived at the Jellum Tavern, there was a sign asking to put your weapon, to leave your weapons at the entrance. And I left the weapon from all the party in that place before entering the tavern. And that was I always did that the first few times I played. And also in that same tavern at night, the patrons at the tavern, they start fighting each other.
Yes.
And they can hit you as well. But none of them is armed.
Yep, it's just a big fist fight. And the thing is, if you hit back, it instantly becomes a combat situation, you know, the same as if you'd attacked any NPC just regularly. So I don't know if they just didn't have the memory or the time to properly script that in, but it always struck me as kind of, you know, an oversight that you could walk into the bar at night, into the middle of the fist fight, and everybody could just bonk you merrily away, and they'd knock off a hit point or two at a time. So it was no big deal. You could just walk out of the bar without, you know, getting seriously wounded. But if you tried to join in the fun, well, all of a sudden, help, guards, everyone's actually hostile to you, and now it's a very different situation entirely. So maybe call that an incompletely implemented thing. I don't know. It was that was always a weird situation. I remember leaving my weapons at the door a couple of times too at the tavern, and that was all fun and games until the two-handed sword that I had picked up off of some enemy disappeared on me. I wasn't happy about that. Because Ultima 6 had that thing, right, where there were two categories of objects. Yeah, there were the persistent world, like there were persistent objects, which is basically if an object had been placed in the world, mm-hmm. not in a monster's inventory, but in the world, by, you know, the designers that you could pick up, you could put that thing down again and it would just stay where it was, you know, wherever
same
you left
for,
it.
Same for items you bought in shops.
Yep. And yeah, anything you bought in a shop or anything you found as loot was dynamically generated by the engine. And you consequently, if you put it down and walked out of view, it would get deallocated. And, oh, geez, where'd my sword go?
No, actually, you could the items you bought at the shops, they would stay.
The wow. items that were on the shelves in the shops, yes. But if you bought no, them, no,
I
they
mean,
would disappear.
I bought items and they stayed.
Well, again, they would stay for a while, but if you walked too far away, they would get deallocated.
I'm talking about making several trips to Moonglow and finding items I brought.
Wow. You could do that?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. I mean, having played Ultima 6, I played it straight through doing the actual plot and just wanted to like get the experience and did the little stuff like baking the bread and trying to sell it. And that's something I never knew. What's with this bar fights? I was in the middle of doing something when I heard that. I was like, bar fights? Well, like, you can get into bar fights in Ultima 6?
It's a scripted sequence in, it's just in Jalom.
Oh.
And the idea is that, you know, the townsfolk nightly test their valor by having a bar
by
fight.
Drinking?
By drinking.
I think they bought that up in, I think they did that in Ultima 7 too.
Maybe, I don't recall.
Now that come to think of it.
But yeah, so if you walk into the bar once it starts to get dark, you'll see people attacking each other. And it goes on for a little while. And then, you know, I mean, you can just leave the bar and whatever. But yeah, it's just if for whatever reason you decide to join in the fun, then all of a sudden everybody's actually hostile to you as opposed to just wandering around kind of randomly bonking people. So don't do that.
Oh, I got a few items. I could just go with one. This happened to me with Ultima. And it wasn't one gameplay feature. It was like all of the gameplay features combined. I don't think they intended them to distract people so badly because they were so awesome that they would actually show little to no interest in completing the game.
completing every time my quests. Sisters played Ultima 7.
Yeah, because I was just having so much fun exploring and screwing around and playing with things. I didn't care. Like, I haven't beaten a single Ultima, and I don't feel bad about it, you know? It's like my favorite game series of all time, and it doesn't matter that I didn't beat it.
Well, yeah, that's true, right? I mean, there's plenty of stories about people who just, you know, well before there was Ultima Online, were coming into Britannia, and rather than solving quests or progressing through any storylines, were just fitting in and making their way, you know, becoming cool. One of the citizens of the land and just living that out day after day.
Yeah, my one regret is that there was no way for me to build a house. What I wanted more than anything else was like to go out in the woods somewhere and figure out some way to build a house where I could put my stuff and, you know, stake out my little claim in Britannia.
That Yeah. Admittedly, well, okay. So when I played Ultima 6, what I would invariably do is I would take over a house. Because, yeah, you're right. You couldn't build a house, really. Now, with Ultima 7, the hack mover in the cheat menu, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That led to all kinds of weird and wacky house creations.
Yeah, I didn't get to play around with that as much as I should have. Another one I got is, I think it's called rocket jumping, like in first-person shooters. I'm not sure that at the beginning they intended for it to do that, where you basically get the rocket launcher and you point it at your feet and you jump and shoot, and it combines the velocity from your jump with the blast radius, you know, pushing you. So you can do this super huge jump to get to places where you normally wouldn't be able to get it.
Yep. I remember playing Marathon, which was Bungie's sort of pre-Halo series of first-person shooters, primarily released for Mac OS. And there were sequences in that game where you actually had two different kinds of explosives in that game. The assault rifle had a grenade launcher underneath it, and then there was also a rocket launcher. And there were, you couldn't really do the rocket jump because if you were caught in the blast radius, you took extreme damage. So unless you had the 3x shield boost, there was no way to survive a rocket jump. But grenade jumping was definitely a thing. And there were actually sequences in the game that you could only get to certain, not plot essential content, but still kind of neat or useful stuff via grenade jumping. And this even back in the first game. So, it's nice when the developers kind of figure out, hey, I can do this, and this is probably going to be a thing. We should do something with this.
Yeah, they start actually supporting it once they're aware of it.
Yep.
And the last one that I got is, I'm not sure if this is a bug, but in the first Metroid for the NES, you know, you could do your little morph ball thing. It was like the first power-up that you got. And Metroid had pretty good collision detection. So when Samus was just running around normally and jumping, you had a normal size collision box. But when you turned into the little ball, your collision box shrank to match the sprite. But here's where they screwed up with that little gameplay element, is when you turned into the ball, the ball would hop up a little bit, and your actual XY position, like your coordinate on screen, when you went back and forth from the ball to regular form, the vertical coordinate would actually twitch. It would like jump by a few pixels instead of staying in the same position. So unfortunately, because of this, you could stand in a doorway, the little bubble doors, you shoot the bubble door, you stand where the door was, you let the door regenerate. So you're stuck inside the door. Then you turn into the ball, and then instantly, as soon as you turn into the ball, you hit up again to resume your regular, you know, humanoid form, and it actually teleports you up a few pixels, but you're still stuck, and you keep doing that over and over, and it actually, you get stuck in the wall, and you go higher and higher and start scrolling the screen upwards through solid walls, and sometimes there'd be nothing up there, and sometimes there'd be, like, weird little debug rooms. Like,
jeez.
Yeah, it was, like, stuff that the developers just left in there. They didn't fill it in with solid tiles because they knew nobody could get to it, so they just left it there, so it was just, like, random crap. The level designers, I guess, I don't know, had created. So that was kind of funky.
Neat. It's always fun to find that kind of stuff. I always liked finding that in like the Commander Keen games, you know, turning on the no clipping cheat and then just sort of flying around a level and seeing like what weird and wacky stuff was lurking outside the margins. And sometimes, you know, there's interesting stuff to be found for sure. Now, here's something that's maybe worth asking, because, you know, this has sort of been this is the related question that's also been on our ideas list for a while. If a game developer implements a game mechanic that is in some way exploitable, but then after realizing this, fails to fix it for an extended period of time, does that mean that they are condoning exploiting that mechanic? Now, obviously, in the case of like early Nintendo games, Metroid and what have you, you could make the argument for no, because how do you issue a patch for a cartridge? But in this day and age, if there's a game mechanic that is particularly exploitable and then doesn't really get fixed, not for a long time or maybe not ever, what is that telling us about what the developer thinks about some of the exploits that players are coming up with?
That either they're really, really lazy or they don't or they don't read the QA bug reports. Or I guess they would condone it. I mean, if it added value to the game and there weren't any significant negative side effects, like it wasn't causing the game to just straight up crash and one out of 20 times or something, then I guess they would. Like an example of that, I thought of another one is, and again, there was no real way for them to patch this because it was so old, but like in Street Fighter 2, the combos in Street Fighter 2 was like a complete accident. So it was like an unintended gameplay feature that was discovered by players that turned into be, you know, an absolute staple of not just fighting games, but almost like any game with real-time combat in it. But it was some kind of bug related to the timing of move execution.
Really? I did not know that.
Never heard of that. That's amazing.
Yeah, I know, it's weird. Like, one of the most like iconic things out there, combo systems, was a freaking accident. It's pretty awesome.
I mean, I guess it kind of makes sense to a degree, but
just goes to show, happy accidents. Yeah, like Bob Ross said, you have happy accidents.
It almost makes me wish that there was... What I always wished, coming back to Ultima for a minute, is like in Ultima Underworld, right? With the runic magic. I always wished that there had been... what's a way to put this? Undocumented spells? Besides Armageddon. I mean, I know the Armageddon spell's there. But just like, you know, say there was a spell that took two runes. And I have a third rune slot that I can use. So it's like, okay, well, what happens if I cast... I'm going to pick on, what if there were... I'll give you an example. And again, I'm probably stepping outside what was actually in Ultima Underworld, but I'll give you an example. Like, what if there was a gust spell that took two runes to catch, right? So I cast the spell, I select these two runes, and it sends a gust of wind that knocks something down. And then what if I had added a flame rune or a poison rune? So all of a sudden, instead of just a straight up gust of wind, now I'm sending a gust of a jet of hot air or a jet of toxic air towards whatever I'm targeting, right? Just, it's, they were, and I mean, again, Ultima Underworld, okay, 1992, maybe they just didn't have the ability, the memory or the ability to script, the spell system in such a way that it could, that the runes could be additive in that way. So it's like, you know, they couldn't necessarily script it in such a way that, yeah, okay, well, if you have this spell that has this effect, but then you add this additional rune to it, that puts this additional effect on it. Like that would be fairly complex to try and accommodate for. But it was something that I always wanted. And it sounds like they're kind of trying to do something like that with Underworld Ascendant now. And I look forward to seeing how that was done. Divinity Original Sin does this as well, right? In a way. Because, you know, Divinity Original Sin, if you have opponents who are standing in or near water, you can use electricity spells to, you know, deliver a shock to them. And standing in water enhances the effect of that. Or you can use freezing spells to suddenly make it very difficult for them to maintain balance. Just lots of little things like that. But I don't know. That was just something I always wanted to see, was just sort of that additive effect where it's like I could just keep chaining together different spell effects to create essentially undocumented magic within the game to use against opponents.
Yeah, since nobody else is jumping in, I'm amazed nobody else is jumping in on that. But dude, that's one of the best ideas ever. That's awesome. They should have done that. And what's cool is you were talking about them doing it with runes, like in Ultima Underworld. But in the regular Ultima games, you had 8 reagents that you'd have to mix. And then I can't remember if they were called Words of Power or something else, but
yeah,
like Amnox or whatever. Power, all yeah. of that. Right. So there were 26 of them, one for each letter of the alphabet. So imagine if they. You know, basically, like you're saying, they came up with, okay, we got fire, we got ice, you know, or hot and cold, or, you know, heal or harm. You came up with all these different properties that could actually affect the game world, and then you associated them with these words of power. And other words would be like how they were used. Like, does it happen to the caster? Does it happen to somebody else? And then similarly for the 8 reagents. So you would have if they made it a system where they didn't have to hand pick what exactly every combination would do, that would have been incredible, because you could have just sat there experimenting, you know, things literally blowing up in your face, you know, occasionally, to try to figure out the ultimate spell for whatever purpose you wanted. And the developers would have had no idea that it was even, you know, what it was. You would figure it out.
And that's exactly the problem with doing that. There have been games that have tried that. I can't think of any of them, the names right offhand. Although to jump for a moment, there are some undocumented spells in Ultima Underworlds, just not ones that are built off of tacking something onto another spell.
Yeah. I mean, I know Armageddon is one of them, and there's a couple of others.
Right. But there's a Jump, Water Walk. Right. Underworld 2 has more of them. Mm. But the I've known people who have tried to set up things where spells are just built out of building blocks and you just put them together, and you know, the coder, you know, just codes what happens when this is mixed in and lets everything else be emergent. And I'm sure that it is possible to balance it well, but the experience that I've seen usually when you have that many combinations is that once the players get a hold of it, and you know, thousands of players are hammering on it and posting to forums or whatever, is you wind up with about three spells ever getting used ever, because they are, because somehow some unforeseen combination of how things get put together means that this combination of things just means that nothing else is necessary to do. And so you're frequently better off just having an explicit list of spells so that at least sometimes this other word of power gets used, because there's nothing else that does anything like that, because you made it so there's nothing else that does that.
Mm. Wow. I'm spitballing here, but my thought would be that, you know, one possible way to limit that, to limit the ability of players to just, you know, yeah, devise the Uber spell that you need not use anything else, is, you know, because again, we're talking about combining, let's stick with the example of Ultima, right? Because we're talking about combining things like reagents and words of power or magic runes. And it would seem one way to limit that would be to associate a mana cost with the use of each additional thing, right?
Yeah, there'd have to be some kind of sacrifice, whether it was the cost or amount of reagents required, what level the character was to even be able to pull it off. And you were saying like mana or something like that. Well, imagine if another variable was actually your health. So you could you can cast Armageddon, but it will, like, you know, tear apart every atom in your body in order to pull it off, like a nuclear bomb. Like, you're not going to survive it either. So there'd have to be, it would be balanced with some sort of cost to the player in one or multiple ways.
Exactly. It's like, so I mean, you know, you could cast the great Uber spell that you found on Reddit, but then you got to sleep for 8 hours to be able to do anything magical again. So I don't know, just spitballing, but that would seem to be the one obvious way to try and impose a limit is.
Didn't they do that in Morrowind? Didn't they do that in Elder Scrolls Morrowind? You could mix and match spells like that?
You know what? I have not dipped my toe sufficiently into Morrowind to be able to tell you.
Huh. There was a system of spell casting in which you could mix all kinds of things to create all kinds of spells with adverse effects, and you could combine all things like drugs. There's a drug in there called Skooma. If you consumed a bunch, it made you uber fast. You could disenchant these blinding boots that you get at the very beginning of the game with certain alchemy and enchantment magic, because there was all kinds of magic in Elder Scrolls. That sounds like something I heard of in Morrowind. And this is nothing I've done myself. This is something I've researched online with playthroughs and things of Morrowind, because I played Morrowind, but I hadn't beat it. So then here with that kind of system sounds like something they put into Elder Scrolls, which is why Morrowind is such a favorite, because of the magic system for all the people who are hardcore into the game. And it's ironic because the magic system in Morrowind is derivative of only three elements of fire, ice, and lightning. But you can mix and match combinations.
I could have a lot of fun with fire and lightning.
You can do dual fire and lightning in Skyrim. Pretty cool.
Well, I mean, coming back to like the Divinity Original Sin concept, right? I mean, think about, you know, here's one where you could do that additively, right? You know, you hit them with like a combined 1-2 punch of ice and fire. So they are now soaked and standing in a pool of water. And then you hit them with lightning, right?
Is Divinity an online game or an...
It has a multiplayer... Well, Divinity Original Sin 2 has a really great multiplayer component, apparently. Very... very much a callback to like Neverwinter Nights DM mode. But no, Divinity Original Sin and its sequel are intended primarily... Well, no, actually, let me back that up. They are entirely playable as single-player offline RPGs, but they were designed from the get-go for couch co-op. The idea for Divinity Original Sin, as I recall Sven Vink at Larian Studios explaining it, was that he wanted an RPG he could play with his girlfriend. Just sitting on their couch at home. And so The best experience of Divinity Original Sin is when you have a second player with you and, you know, each of you controls one player character and you navigate through the world. And like, it's got all these neat systems in play. Well, neat or potentially inconvenient systems in place where, like when you're at a decision point in a conversation tree, each person, you know, because there's the two characters and there's always the two characters. There's the guy and the girl, and at a decision point in a conversation tree, each of them will get a say. And if they agree, fine, that's just what happens. But if they disagree, then, the game does some behind the scenes work, you know, based on player stats and some other stuff to figure out whose opinion wins out and whose decision wins out to determine next course of action. So, yeah, cool. It's some pretty funky mechanics there. And I mean, like, even though it is the two characters together, they can split up, which creates a really weird mechanic too when it comes to combat, because the game itself plays out in real time, but combat is turn-based. So if one character's caught in combat, they suddenly get transported to this weird turn-based timescale. Transported is the wrong word because you stay on the same map, but all of a sudden they become turn-based, whereas the other person is still moving around in real time if they're not in combat. So it's like, anyways, yeah, it's a neat game that has been designed from the ground up for two players, but I've played it as a single player RPG. And apart from some, you know, concerns I have with the rather slow pacing at the start, eminently playable as a single player RPG and not... You know, it's kind of funny because Divinity Original Sin always leaves a little bit of a bad taste in my mouth. The original was pitched as very much also an attempt to homage Ultima 7, but before they shipped, they had to strip out NPC schedules and day-night cycles. And so consequently, it's like I play it and it's like I can so see so many points where this would be a quite reasonable modern take on what Ultima 7 was able to do. But the world is just a little too static because the sun never sets and the shopkeepers never go home at night.
In the Divinity games?
Yeah, just, I mean, the original Divinity games were more, well, okay. Divine Divinity, which is kind of a cumbersome name, admittedly, was kind of a Diablo clone with a little bit more RPG mechanics and a little bit more story. Divinity 2 was kind of Dragon Age-y, I guess you could liken it to. And then there were some other games like the completely weird and wonderful Divinity Dragon Commander, which is kind of like a RTS, but you could jump into the battlefield as kind of a third-person, sort of in like a third-person shooter. So yeah, it was like mainly an RTS, but then you could jump into the battlefield as a third-person shooter. You were playing a dragon knight, so you had a human form, but you could also turn into a dragon with a jetpack. I don't know how that couldn't be awesome, but there it is.
And very riffs.
Yes.
Any outplayed riffs before? There you go.
So
I'm a fan of that game too.
Yep. So yeah, they Larian Studios have had a lot of fun with the Divinity label over the years, but I think Divinity Original Sin and now its sequel, Original Sin 2, have been the most effective uses of the property. And certainly as RPGs, probably some of their best work.
Hmm.
And speaking of games,
guys who know what they're doing.
Yeah.
Speaking of games supporting two player, another unintended result of gameplay is the people playing the game deciding that they want to completely change the intended goal of the game, which is similar to what I was saying before with not trying to complete the game, but a little bit different. For example, Joust for the NES supported two players. So you're going around, you know, killing the bad guys and all that good stuff. What I would do, maybe because I was a dick when I was younger, I would try to kill my brother because Joust had friendly fire. If you ran into the other ostrich or knight or whatever, and you were like 1 pixel higher than they were, you'd kill them. So I would just beeline right at him every time, just desperately just trying to cling to the top of the platform to stay as high as I could, flapping as fast as I could. And I turned Joust into a deathmatch game. And to me, that was more fun than playing in the way it was supposed to be played.
Yeah, that sounds awesome.
My brother didn't think it was awesome, but that made it even more fun.
Glad to know I'm talking to fellow lovers of old arcade games.
There you go.
Oh, yes.
You guys probably hang out at the barcades, don't you?
I need to find one around here. I'm like in the suburbs of Atlanta, so there's probably one somewhere. I'm trying to make one in my house. That's the long-term goal.
I don't really hang out at arcades, but occasionally I take my kids to some of the play places around here, which have, I mean, you're definitely not going to find any, you know, classics, and you're definitely not going to find any fighting games, but there are, well, no, that's not true. Those, like the dinosaur shooter games seem to still be popular, but a lot of the play places around here have... Yeah, and if you're not familiar with the play place concept, it's like basically a huge indoor jungle gym, or sometimes it's a big trampoline park. But either way, most of such places have a little arcade attached to them. Cool. And, you know, you can, mostly the way it works is, you know, you can just, with your admission, you get a set amount of tokens, and you can buy more tokens, and then you play the games, and you get tickets. And then you can, you know, like the machines spit out tickets based on how well you've done in the games, and then you can redeem the tickets for different prizes. But yeah, so there's still a thing in certain limited aspects around here up in Alberta, Canada. So, but no, like I can't think of any dedicated arcades in the area. So, or barcades for that matter.
It's a very niche market.
Wow. And we've got quite a few up in here in Louisville. That's the big thing for all the nerds, board game meetups and barcades. People who got here, let's see, we got one called the Zanzibar that's really popular. I'm a member of my cartoonist society, comic book artists. We like to meet. We have what we call drink and draws, but we go to the barcades. But we go to the barcades. So when we get done drawing and drinking, we play a few games before we go home. Pinball and arcade classics. Dude, oh, man, Louisville's, people don't think much of Louisville. Louisville's popping, man. There's all kinds of things to do out here.
You just got to drive a bit.
And
I wish I had.
And hey, if you want to get out of the city, you don't have to go far. Three things we got: barcades, bourbon, and hot browns. and derby.
Full disclosure:
we just passed derby season, so
that was too
Louisville. I was out. I was at a friend's wedding, but you don't want to be in Louisville on derby season, on derby day, even with the rain, come rain, sleet, or snow, or global warming, or ice age. The people of Kentucky will come for miles or wherever they come to bring their horses, put on their derby hats. The ladies. And men wearing their most dandy suits and come out, drink, get crazy, and watch the horses run for 5 minutes and then go home. And traffic is terrible. Things get crashed into. People get arrested. Fights break out. It's crazy.
Well, other than that, it sounds awesome.
I'll tell you this.
If you all ever get the chance to come up this way, definitely come up this way or down, wherever you're coming from.
Hey, I'm in Atlanta. I'm not too far.
Yeah, I wish I'd known because, like, I don't work for Honeywell anymore, but when I did, two of my repeat projects were a mine in southern Indiana, and a power company in Kentucky.
Oh, so, when did you work for Honeywell?
Say what?
When did you work for Honeywell?
From about 2008 to about 2013.
What do they do? Because I get job offers from them all the time.
Well, I was with their industrial cybersecurity group.
Oh, so you were a programmer?
Partly. And so I did a lot of work with a mine in southern Indiana. And like I say, with the power company one of the power companies out in Kentucky. And consequently, my first introduction to Louisville, I was in Indiana and it was a 2-week job. So I'd gotten there on Monday. It was Friday afternoon and I knew I was going to be there over the weekend. I wasn't flying home because I had more work to do the following week. I'd be right back at the mine site on Monday. I'm like, well, what the heck am I supposed to do? Like, what's fun around here? And the guys at the mine are just like, you are in the middle of nowhere, Indiana. Like, there is basically nothing to entertain yourself with outside of what's available to you in your hotel room. There's places to go and grab a bite to eat, but that's about it. So they're like, unless you're willing to drive to Indianapolis or Louisville, you're going to be bored all weekend. So I booked a hotel in Louisville just off of 4th Street Live, and I went there for the Saturday and the Sunday, and it was awesome. I left really stupid early. I got checked into the hotel kind of mid-morning, and I just I spent all Saturday morning just exploring. I brought back a personalized slugger for my wife.
Cool.
And I mean, I took in about half the restaurants on 4th Street Live. The next morning, just behind 4th Street Live was the Catholic Cathedral, so I went to Mass there and then hung out in town for pretty much the rest of the day, explored a little bit more, and went home. And I mean, subsequent trips, whether I was working for the mine or doing work at the mine or doing work for the power company in Louisville, because I was, you know, working with them on cybersecurity program stuff at the various different power substations and plants around the area, always hit up 4th Street Live. I'd always hit up the cathedral. And I think I've brought back a total of about 7 personalized sluggers for people. Like, they were just my go-to gift item for the longest time. I have a lot of people in my family who really like fastball and softball. But I wish I'd known about the barcades. I'd have totally checked them out too. And I did do a big tour to the other Edmonton though. So that was not bad.
Oh. Well, if you ever come back this way, I and my wife are part of the design and nerd community and the art community. They now have a group that she associates with because she's a web developer called a Game Dev Lou. And Louisville makes games. It's all part of Louisville's intrepid quest to get programming established in Louisville, because Louisville in the future may or may not be a Google Fiber city.
Ah.
And what's another one? They do education for web development, networking, business networking, cybersecurity programming, and now somebody's experimenting with making their own version of Alexa out of Louisville. It's a couple of guys that are associated with the Cartoonist Society. One of them's a teacher. And these people are all geniuses. I mean, I couldn't believe there was such a genius community, young people. They're trying to make Alexa. And one of their first projects from the last web development meetup I went to, and I'm unfortunately unemployed right now, so I've been 3 months out of work, so I go to all these now trying to get, because I'm trying to build up a graphic design portfolio and get into my career. My wife works for JCPS, and the guys that she introduced me to made their own choose your own adventure with their own version of an Alexa. Get that, huh?
That'd be all right.
Like, talk to Alexa, start off in this area, and then Alexa responds back, you are in this room, you are doing this thing, there's something to the left, there's something to the right. It was so fun to listen to Alexa.
I apologize for the background noise. I was just looking over at the shelf of games in the room here, and I noticed the Island of Dr. Brain box. So I was just flipping through it there. My eldest is working through it. At the moment, when she's not busy playing Minecraft and designing absolutely wacky structures therein. So, but I'm looking through it, and it's just like, I got all the old manuals in here. This is great. Not much that I can really use to liken that to any of the things that we've discussed. You know, the Island of Dr. Brain was a fairly straight up adventure game. Although, I mean, in the Sierra Discovery series, right? So, you know, sort of more educational and stuff, but oh my gosh, I forgot how cool this manual was. You know, I guess in another way though, like that, I guess in some ways the manuals could kind of be considered a gameplay feature, right? You know, especially like, I mean, I'm looking at the manual here and when was this? Anyway, you know, I'm looking at the manual here and it's, you know, it's basically a handbook for how to solve the game, right? Not in the sense of like a true hint book, but certainly in the sense of, you know, like, well, there's the map for the copy protection. And then it starts to explain like the polynomials game or how to do Fibonacci sequences and who Fibonacci was and things like that, right? So things that will definitely help you progress through the puzzles that the game throws at you. And, you know, very much like a manual for Ultima, written in-universe. But, you know, like, I guess in a certain way, those old manuals could be a bit of a gameplay feature too. And again, for the wrong kind of player, or for, wrong is the wrong word to use, but for a particular kind of player, could be a bit of a stumbling block, right? You know, I mean, for some people, poring over the manuals and reading every word and just digesting all of the information therein is awesome. It's a wonderful experience. But, you know, for other people, like something like the Encyclopedia here for the Island of Dr. Brain, it's a lot to take. It could be a lot to take in and maybe could wind up being off-putting too. So I don't know.
Reminds me of Police Quests. I remember the manual has police procedures for several situations and you find yourself in those situations in game. And if you don't follow procedure, you lose the game and have to reload from a save game.
Yep. Sounds about right.
Yeah. Another thing I was remembering when Kevin talked about the rocket jumping, when I played Tabula Rasa, there was a skill from the commando class, which hurled your body against an enemy, and on impact, the enemy would just be thrown away, would fly away like a projectile after the impact. And afterwards, I would just aim with my rocket launcher and fire at them while they were on midair.
Nice. Nowadays, you can get a Steam achievement for that, eh?
So you created a mini game trying to jib them after they're already a corpse, basically while they were flying through the air. That's cool.
I guess in a way.
And when you mentioned the runic magic from Ultima Underworld, I was remembering pen and paper role-playing game. It's called Iron Heroes, and the magic system was quite flexible and tried to be simple in many ways. And here's the manual section. Say it reads, in game terms, casting a spell involves three steps. Step one, an arcanist must determine how much mana to gather. If he tries to gather more than he can normally handle, he might push his body and mind beyond their levels of endurance. Step two, he decides what he wants to do with the mana and sculpt it into his desired form. Step three, with the spell shaped to his liking, the arcanist then attempts to channel it into reality. This last step is the most important portion of the process. If the arcanist successfully channels the spells, it has its desired effects. If he fails, the spell runs wild. And it has several pages of rules on how to shape the spells, the dice rolling, skill checks. That's one of the systems.
It's and a little bit more than just a straight up fizzle.
Yeah, and another system I've used is the one from Mutants and Masterminds, which is it has rules for determining the effect. You just define a spell based on the general effect it has, and the manual has cost for the for what you want to do. The even the there's cost different cost for the rank of the spell. If you want a more powerful spell, it costs more, and there are attributes and modifiers for if you want single target, multi-target, area spell, that changes the cost. And then there are the descriptors, which they don't change cost, but they modify the spell. For example, you can add the fire descriptor to the effects are effects like damage, affliction, and that kind of stuff. And you define a damage effect and you add the fire descriptor and that makes it into a fire spell. Or you add a different descriptor and you, for example, add an affliction and you add the poison descriptor to the affliction and define the effects it has. And it's quite flexible. And you nice. Can define it yourself when you create the character or when you acquire the powers.
Yeah, I guess you can always be way more complex with a pen and paper than you're ever going to be able to get away with in a computer game. You know, just because you have the GM there who is always able to, you know, adjust and adapt with a human mind to every situation. And that's not something, at least for the foreseeable future, that we're going to be able to do very effectively with even an obscene amount of scripting. You know, there's always going to be limits to what scripting can accommodate versus what human imagination is capable of. Anyways.
I don't know, man. I think AI will surpass humans sooner than we might expect.
Maybe at some point. I don't discount that possibility entirely. I'm just not certain how soon it's gonna be.
Skynet, the whole thing's coming soon. Get ready.
In many aspects it already has. Actually AI for games is not actually AI in the same sense of others. Actually, several people who study AI call the game AI artificial stupidity. Because they don't want it to be a very smart and perfect intelligence. They want it to be just as stupid as a human being. they wanted to simulate human stupidity to make it the somewhat believable or predictable in terms of gameplay or behavior.
Well, and I mean, in the end, you know, you want to be able to challenge the player, right? But at the same time, you know, you don't want the challenge to be completely insurmountable. You know, even in the case of like a Dark Souls type game where you expect a much steeper difficulty curve going in, it should ultimately be something that players can get through. It might take them a long time to do it, but they should be able to get through it, because if not, they're going to say, well, what the heck's the point of this? And they're not going to come back.
And that reminded me of Legend of Zelda: Ocarina of Time. That was, at least in my opinion, the AI was quite disappointing to me when compared to the previous games. On previous games, you have to actually figure out how to attack certain enemies and try to get around them and attack them on the back and that stuff. On Ocarina of Time, most of the combat is just Z target while blocking, wait for them to deliberately open their guard and show their vulnerable zone for you to hit it. You slash at them and then you just wait for the next chance or the next time they show you their vulnerable spot. And on much different than the other games where you where they didn't do that. You would have to go around them.
Indeed. Well, it's actually not a bad note to end on, I think. And unfortunately, I do have to bring this to a bit of an end because my wife needs a hand upstairs. Gosh, we're getting close now. Okay. Maybe a month and then we'll have another baby in the house.
Aww.
Stuff's getting real, man. Stuff's getting real. All right. Well, if you like Spam, Spam, Spam Humbug, you can, of course, support us on Patreon. And not just the podcast, actually. That is also the means to support the Ultima Codex to help pay for hosting fees and all that good stuff. Patreon.com/Ultima Codex. Now, if a monthly subscription ain't your thing, well, hopefully you like playing video games. I mean, if you're listening to this podcast, I would assume you like playing video games. And if so, I would encourage you to buy your video games at GOG. And if you hit up the show notes for this episode or ultimacodex.com, we've got some banners in the sidebar. Either way, click on through via the link in the notes or the sidebar banners and go about your business at GOG. You don't pay a cent more, but we get a little bit of commission. And again, all goes towards hosting fees and podcast hosting fees and all that good stuff. But we do also welcome your moral support. You can like Ultima on Facebook, facebook.com/theultimaseries, and you can follow at Ultima Codex on Twitter. And not just that, we would definitely encourage you to do both of those things. Like us, follow us, but share. You know, if you see something go up on either of those that you think is interesting and you think other people might find interesting, please retweet, share to your Facebook wall, all that good stuff. Now, if you want to join the Ultima community, UDSC.org is your gateway to selecting your very own dragon name. You can also find the Ultima Dragons on Facebook and on Google+. You can follow at Ultima Dragons on Twitter for all your daily Cinnabon jokes. There is a Slack group or Slack channel. I can't remember what the correct terminology is, but it's kind of underpopulated. There's only a couple of us that really hang out in there at all. The Discord server, though, gets a lot more traffic, sees a lot more conversation. Links for all of this will be in the show notes, and you're welcome to join both. And finally, if you're feeling old school and you want to catch some dragons in sort of their other unofficial home, the Wearmount. You'll need a Telnet client to access it, but it is an experience unto itself. Very, very worthwhile if you have the time and a little bit of patience to navigate the very retro experience that it is. Finally, you can send us some feedback. UltimaCodex@gmail.com. If you want to shoot us an email, you can leave us a voice message. There'll be a link in the show notes or go to podcast.ultimacodex.com and look for a link to that effect. Or you can join us on our Discord server. Again, link in the show notes. This is where we record these episodes, so you're more than welcome to contribute to episodes when they're recorded or just to lurk the channel and listen to things as they go down. All right. Well, Balron, where can we find you online?
I'm currently on Facebook, but you can also look at me. I've changed up my name. I'm trying to become more professional. My Twitter feed is at R Rivera Creative. And then I have a LinkedIn now, Roberto Rivera Creative, and a Behance at Roberto Rivera Creative. I'm on social media like crazy. And I'm also on Slack. On Louisville Makes Games and Game Dev Lou, but those channels I have trouble getting on. This PC
okay.
isn't built
think
for
they'd
it.
Be
I
so
use my wife's Mac.
Sharing invites to those channels, so that's all right.
I'll send you some. Yeah, they'll send you some through here. Yeah, and I've since changed my name up, and Facebook is still me. And I'm part of Ultima Dragons already. I've just never been on the Wearmount. And that was something I was going to ask. Yeah, there's where's the client to the Wearmount, and how do you get on that? I'd like to get into that because I put out a message that I'd taking up programming and that I'd like to get into trying to help modify on the Ultima 7. What is that? The Ultima 7 programming page that's still active. People are like messing with the Ultima 7 pages and making their own games with them and stuff like that. I don't know if that's still a thing or not, if that's still an Ultima project, because I'm trying to teach myself C+ and C#. Me and my wife are using Unity.
Right. Well, you know what? If you need to know how to get onto the Wearmount, your best bet is to just go to www.wearmount.org. That's W-E-Y-R wearmount.org. And in this case, the www is actually important. If you just try and go to wearmount.org, you're going to get an error page. So www.wearmount.org. And if you go there, they have links to their, well, A, they have links to recommended Telnet clients for PC, Mac, Linux, iOS, and Android. And they also have an introduction to Moo programming. So if you actually do want to start building content for the Wearmount. So cool. There's your answer, sir. Hit up that website.
I have a website. Is that what you ask? Because my thing went down just now.
No. I said, there is your answer, sir. Hit up that website, www.wearmount.org.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah. There you go. Let's see. Boolean, how about you?
As always, you can find me at 8virtues.com if you want to buy a Linux-based PC or listen to some cool chiptune music via my internet radio station. And everywhere else, 8virtues, Kevin Fishburne, etc.
Brilliant. Draxenath, how about you?
You can find me on Steam as Draxenath. And soon I may also be streaming on Twitch. My stream will be about what I call cryptid games. What does it mean? It means games few people know, even indie games or games that were available some time ago and you can no longer find online.
Nice. Golden Flame, how about you?
You can find me on the UDIC Facebook page. You can find me on both the UDIC and Spam Humbug's Discord servers. And you can find me at tapestryofages.com.
Sweet deal. And of course, you can find me, WTF Dragon. Well, let's see. I'm on Twitter at WTF_Dragon. I am on Facebook. You can find me at the Ultima Codex. I have an about.me splash page. There'll be a link in the show notes. That'll take you to various other of my social media profiles. And if you're involved with the scouting movement at all, you might want to check out my other podcast, Scouting Stuff. That's at scoutingstuffpodcast.com. All right. Well, thank you everyone for being here. And sorry for kind of the hard close, but I should really go be a good husband for at least the last few minutes of the night. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And until next time, be virtuous.